You don't experiment on people, period, right? I mean, you don't take risks with people else. That's what clinical trials are for. That's the reason it's regulated. But there's a lot of other things in healthcare where, frankly, we have not experimented enough in terms of how we can make the experience better, how we can operate better. That's not about the treatment and the patient, but the whole surround sound system. So I think one of the things you do is you start changing the mindset. And instead of measuring everything in healthcare by the outcomes razor of do no harm, which is really what a clinical trial is, get a little bit more aggressive in terms of how you think about the change for some of the other components of the care model.
Welcome to A&M Healthcare Industry Group's What's Your Moonshot podcast series, where world-class healthcare leaders seek to solve big problems. Listen as we talk to today's health system CEOs about the journey to achieve their moonshots.
Welcome to A&M's What's Your Moonshot podcast series. I'm John Coyle, and I'm joined by my co-host, Donna Holna, who is a fellow managing director in the A&M Healthcare Industry Group. Today, we are thrilled to have Klaus Jensen on our podcast. Klaus is the Chief Technology Officer at the University of Texas Medical Center and Dell Medical School. In this role, he's leading the innovation and technology elements of establishing a new academic medical center, the first of its kind in the Austin metropolitan area. Welcome, and we're looking forward to a great discussion.
Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks.
Well, let's jump right in. Klaus, please tell us about your moonshot, specifically the challenges your teaching hospital will face in preparing a new generation of doctors to deliver care in any setting with more data, digital opportunities, and in a new era of AI.
So moonshot is an interesting term because it sort of signifies something that takes a while. It's not going to happen tomorrow. It's probably also big and complicated. So here's our big and complicated thing. As you mentioned, Austin does not have an academic medical center right now. So what do academic medical centers do? Well, they do research, they do education, and they always take care of people. But more importantly, they're an integral part of the community, and they help organize and orchestrate sort of the larger healthcare ecosystem in whatever area they're in. It's been a while since anybody who doesn't have a hospital or an academic medical center already has built one. And you know, the last 5 years have been eventful. Pandemic, AI, emergence of virtual care. The real moonshot question is, how do you build an academic medical center that when it opens in 2030 is not already outdated? Because the last many hospitals people have built, they will all say they were outdated when the doors opened. So how do you prevent that?
So Klaus, you know, it's very interesting to hear that, and you're absolutely right. How do you make sure that when you open the door to patients and medical students that you're still current? But as you think about your digital opportunities in the world of AI, and we all have different definitions of digital first, digital front door, what is your vision for, what are you thinking of that smart digital hospital? What does it have to include when you open your doors in 1930?
It's a really good question, and it's very multifaceted. So the simple way of answering it is there's going to be lots of virtual care. Like, that's a silly answer because we're already doing that. I mean, that's not future-proof. But you can ask that asking different questions. So usually you ask a question that says, how can the built environment help support the care team? You think about AI, you think about robots, you think about agentic, all those buzzwords that are floating around. Is that the right question? Or should you ask, how can the building be part of the care team? How can the building be part of the research team? How can the building help educate? So you shift the role of the built environment from being passively enabling to being actively participating. Once you mentally make that switch, everything changes. Because you could be thinking about every single thing that you think you have to design into this multi-billion dollar building, you have to think about it differently. If it's an active participant and doesn't just support and enable the people in the building. Whether that is, how do you transport goods? Is there a drone pad at the loading dock? What does embedded research look like? Are the hallways in your, you know, patient floor is going to be 8 feet or 10 feet? That's actually an interesting question. Yeah. If they're 8 feet, is there room for both people and robots? Or do you need 10 feet so everybody can coexist a little more comfortably? We must have at this point like 300 or 400 questions of that kind, which all poke at the boundary of what is the fusion of clinical, digital, behavioral, logistical, and data science.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
So Klaus, I love the framing around how can the building be an active participant? That brings out so many questions, but let me ask one that's a little bit more pedestrian. How have you been thinking about the design for funding of the hospital and the plan to continue and update going forward?
Multiple ways of answering that question. There was obviously an announcement from a lot of important players in Texas, in Austin. So we do expect to get support from all the people that were part of conceiving the fact of an academic medical center. We're part of University of Texas. That's important. We're actually co-building with MD Anderson. So this is not going to be a single institution site. It's going to be a dual institution site. That's actually quite fascinating because you're not thinking about what is each institution particularly good at. In the end, any build of this sort has to rest in itself when it comes to its operational metrics once it opens. Right? So there is the initial capital, which will come from different places. Hopefully some people will be generous with the dollars that will stand this up in Austin. But more importantly, we have to build something that isn't just future-proof, that isn't just about all the many great things we can do for humanity, but it can also carry its own weight from a financial model perspective. And that leads to another interesting question, right? Because most healthcare institutions are basically thinking about how AI and automation can make them reduce their headcount. We're not talking necessarily about replacing people, you know, one-for-one equivalent. We're just talking about operating the facility differently. Now, we need to hire a lot of people. So our question is a little bit different, which is, compared to a traditional standard academic medical center, or even a hospital, which people do we not need to hire? Because we can rethink the way that automation, you know, machine intelligence is, different ways of working, impact what this is going to look like in 2030 and beyond. So it's, again, fascinating tweak on the typical question, which is how can we optimize? There's nothing to optimize. We don't exist yet. What we have right now is a decent-sized research and education enterprise. We certainly have ambulatory care. We do a fair amount of that. And we have physicians that practice in other people's hospital. But as a full-fledged academic medical center, we don't exist yet. So we're on this hockey stick growth curve, and we have to figure out how to navigate that in a way that's hopefully better than what people have done historically.
Oh, that's fascinating. I love the vision for this teaching institution. So back to the frame of the building as participant, how does the building help educate a new generation of clinicians with AI?
Love that question. It's one of the things I spend the most time on. My parents were teachers, and I swore that I would never do that. But actually, I found a love for helping people learn over the years, be that my own teams or the people around us. You can ask yourself, what is the current standard of education? We're not talking standard of care. We're talking traditional way of educating people. There's course material. You go through the course material, you get, you know, examined, and did you learn the course material? That's going to continue to be an important part of that. But let's unwrap it and ask ourselves, what do you actually need to learn as a future physician, as an existing clinician, as a patient, as friends, family, caregivers, et cetera? Let's start with the patients or maybe potential patients. If you feel that your body isn't working the way you think it should, what's the first thing you do? Go look in your favorite browser and you type in some search phrases, and if you're really lucky, you get a good answer. Okay. Is that the best we can do? Or is it possible to create a cocktail of, these are my questions, this is my historical behavior in terms of how I interact with the knowledge base around me, these are my interests, this is what we know from my medical record, this is what my care team thinks I need to learn, and create a personalized modular learning journey where you just start unwrapping one layer at a time of the onion based on whatever it is you need, whether that's 2 p.m. in the afternoon or 2 a.m. in the morning. So again, not replacing what we do, you still need to have the conversation with the care team, but they're not available 24/7. And you know what? There are actually lots of people out there, even people I know, that are more comfortable asking those hard questions and learning it on their own than necessarily having that interaction, at least in the first case, with, you know, with any humans. So that's the one point. Now go all the way over to the physicians. Historically, the way that you learn to trade as a physician is through lots of textbooks. You get examined. And then you start practicing on people. And that's a learning journey. And there's oversight, and that's what residency is all about, etc. But what if we can make that less binary? So that beyond the textbook, there's a digital simulation. There might be a semi-physical simulation. There might be a whole mock-up floor somewhere where I can try out things. There may be robotic approximations of what a human body might look like. I may learn clinical programming differently, because a lot of the equipment these days are actually algorithmically programmable. And then ultimately I progress to that and I start working on people. So can we get away from the binary setup that has been the historical best practice for learning for clinicians? I think we can. And if you look at the continued education, the more we can sense and learn about how people use the space, how they interact, how they behave, you can start thinking about not just clinical research and clinical science, but operational research, operational science, supply chain, flow of materials. There's like a million things that you can actually start thinking into. How do I create this ever-learning environment where it's not just about one aspect and dimension of how thousands of people are working together? It's about all of them at the same time. And the backbone for that is a whole bunch of sensors, a good place to put all the data, and a whole bunch of algorithms you can use to sift through it. That's the beginning of an answer, but I could probably talk about that if you ask.
Well, Klaus, your vision is for the future amazing, and what it's going to do for patient care, being a clinician, is just amazing. It's going to be wonderful when it gets done. How do you accelerate your technology advancements, where you're going with your great plan, which is great, again, how do you consider the risk and all the risk involved and how it's going to affect patient outcomes, including, if you can talk a little bit about those risks, how do you do that with technology, and also yep. including cyber in that, in your design process?
Wow, that's a lot.
It is.
So let's start with, you don't experiment haphazardly on people, period. I mean, you right. just don't take risks with people's health. That's what clinical trials are for. That's the reason it's regulated. But there's a lot of other things in healthcare where, frankly, we have not experimented enough in terms of how we can make the experience better, how we can operate better. That's not about the treatment and the patient, but the whole surround sound system. So I think one of the things you do is you start changing the mindset. And instead of measuring everything in healthcare by the Occam's razor of do no harm, which is really what a clinical trial is, get a little bit more aggressive in terms of how you think about the change for some of the other components of the care model. That's one part, it's cultural. Cybersecurity is on everybody's mind. Look, anybody who tells you they will never have a cybersecurity incident, like ever, probably not true.
Right.
What we're trying to do is to keep it too small and make sure we can manage the fallout of them. So you do cybersecurity by design. You bake it into everything you do. The beauty of not having anything is we don't have anything. So we don't have anything that has existing issues. That's actually not quite true, because we're a going concern that have ambulatory care. But over the next 5 years, pretty much every single piece of what we do today will get replaced, all of it. Any organizational change book will tell you, you can manage one, maybe two change initiatives at a time.
Mm-hmm.
I can do the reverse math from sometime in 2030. I can start looking at what does that roadmap look like? What are the stepping stones? Which things that we have to put in place? There's an electronic medical record platform. There is an ERP platform. There is a data platform. There is a digital platform.
Yeah.
There is a, you know, IT service management platform. Oh, and there's this multi-billion dollar hospital that we have to build as well. There is the growth plan for the ambulatory, you know, care setting we have. There is the build out of research. There is the build of education. When you start counting, just on the technology side, there's a handful. And if you take the institution as a whole, there are dozens. Each of these is a major transformation program. And when you do the math, we have to run 5+ in parallel. So the only way you can do that is by having a great team that knows how to collaborate, being very honest about the state of things. So transparency matters. And then having some people that are really good at keeping a lot of balls in the air and not drop too many of them. It's a little bit daunting when you think about it. But I always believe that the way to get hard things done is to be strategically patient, yet tactically impatient, which is a weird thing to say. As I said, patient and impatient in the same sentence. But it's actually true, because 5 years is a long time and a short time. You have to be patient that you can't do everything at the same time. You have to sequence it the best way you can, accept that there will be some small, hopefully, mistakes along the way. But you got to push hard in the here and now on the ground to make sure you move at a pace that will actually get you to 2030. I don't know if I have a better answer for you on the multifaceted complex question you just asked, but it comes down to something like that.
Thank you.
Also, you bring up team, you bring up patience and sequencing. And of course, the obvious question is governance. And if you just share with us your plans around how to have effective governance and driving effective decision-making with this hospital in a somewhat complicated structure, right? You're affiliated with the state, you've got partnerships with other learning institutions and the Cancer Center and MD Anderson. Tell us about how that's all going to work.
I think you get there by changing the question. Because when people ask about governance, most times they're talking about authority and decision rights. And I don't think that will get us there. Like if we think about what we've talked about in the last 15 minutes or so, if this comes down to who gets to decide what things in isolation, you can spend your entire time on that. Stewardship is shared stewardship of the values, of the dream, of the mission. It is all about how you manage the journey together. It's more about how you deliver the outcome that you're looking for, then it's necessarily about who gets to decide what part. So I think you have to be mentally flexible and accept the fact that in most cases for something like this, there are very few really important things in this kind of project that any single person can actually decide. Now, obviously, our dean can make decisions as to what direction she would like to go in, but nobody in this sort of master plan has every single piece of information. What I think I've learned over the last couple of decades in the C-suite is you got to find your storytellers. If you can find your chief storytellers that are the translators of the organization and make sure that they become the connective tissue as the story evolves, good people make good decisions if they understand the context. And as long as you can make sure people understand the context, you sort of have to trust people to make good decisions and then bring it back together and say, hey, is this cohesive as a whole? It's a little bit different than how you would normally set up a governance model that's looking at decision rates. But I think it's better for when you're trying to be a transitional leadership group that moves an organization from A to B.
That's great. So let me ask, as you think about the role of this new teaching hospital in the great American city that Austin is, how are people going to experience the hospital outside in the continuum of care in the Austin ecosystem of healthcare? How is that?
That's the exciting part of this whole thing, because right? it's really exciting to build the 3 million square feet that we're going to be building between the two institutions. It's like a lot of space. And you can ask lots of interesting questions. But beyond that, what happens outside the walls? What are the partnerships and connections we need to make to the larger Austin healthcare ecosystem? What can we push to people's homes? Do virtual visits on our side have to be in the physical space we're building, or can they sometimes be somewhere else? What is your nursing model going to be like? Are you going to have a one-tier, two-tier, three-tier or four-tier nursing model? Four-tier would be you've got nurses on the floor. You've got nurses that are in larger teams that cover particular dimensions of the academic medical center as a whole, be that research or specialty. The third tier would be you might have nurse sitting, some kind of centralized nursing unit that takes over some of the nursing functions across the entire complex, which could be on-site or off-site. And the fourth tier would be, well, what's the nursing presence in people's home? You can ask the same questions around what does a treatment look like? Where does it end and begin? Look, we know there's going to be moments in time when people don't know us. We hope through education they'll get to know us before they need us. But there's also a time after treatment. When I spent time with Memorial Sloan Kettering, one of the things we spend a lot of time thinking about, because you know, cancer is a lifelong affliction, and in many cases, the treatment you get actually makes you more susceptible to get cancer again. What do you do with the hundreds of thousands of people that have finished their treatment? How do you stay in touch with them? And how do you make them feel that they weren't abandoned when they were discharged? Again, I can rattle off dozens of questions that all have to do with how do you fulfill a bigger mission, which is to be a permanent presence in the ecosystem that's actually there to help people, often digitally, even beyond the advanced treatments that we provide.
You know, Klaus, you have clearly thought really deeply about this opportunity, and John and I have learned so much today from you. What have you learned in this process that others could benefit that are just beginning on this journey? Because you're on the journey, you're well into the journey. What lessons have you learned that you would give to others that would benefit?
Can I give you two?
You sure can.
The first one would be, don't focus on the technology, focus on the people. And look, I'm a technologist turned storyteller, but I always start with the people. That's possibly not where I began 25 years ago, but these days I start with the people. So that's the one. The second one is, and I think it was Joe and Didier who said it, you can't be sure about anything ever. And I can continue with one of my own idioms with this. On the other hand, you can't get back the time you lost by not making a decision. So you have to make a decision based on your vision, your conviction, and your technical mastery. That's it. Those two things.
Very good. Thank you.
Well, Klaus, as we're talking, I'm reflecting on both of us knowing you for a number of years, you know, in your role as the CTO for CVS Aetna, where I met you as the first chief digital officer for Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital, for your role at Teladoc as the head of product, and now, fortunately, as a CTO for the new teaching hospital in Austin. We really are grateful for the opportunity for you to share your vision with us, and we're rooting for you and looking forward to seeing this vision come to fruition.
Thank you.
Grateful to have you.
Alvarez and Marcel. Leadership. Action. Results.